Welcome to another edition of Shedding Light. But before I start, I need to let you know the views or opinions expressed by the host, DJ, or the guests present on KZSU 90.1 FM Stanford do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of the Leland Stanford Junior University or its associates. We thank you for tuning into this KZSU 90.1 FM broadcast and stand by for another exciting edition of Shedding Light right here on KZSU. Is called Moanin'. That's Art Blakey and his Jazz Messengers, and the song was written by Bobby Timmons. A lot of people want to know about that intro song to this show, and I think it's one of the toughest songs ever made, but I digress. Ladies and gentlemen, in the studio today, and I want to thank the producer of this show for setting this up. We're finally starting to make a connection with the students around here. Students are very busy at all colleges, and no exception here. And today, two student activists. We have Shara and Luke. Welcome to KZSU, you two.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Can you please introduce yourselves? Shara, why don't you start?
Yeah, my name is Shara Esbenshade. I'm a sophomore at Stanford.
I'm a sophomore at Stanford, majoring in history, and I'm involved with Stanford's Says No to War. We've been doing a lot about Condoleezza Rice and the movement to hold her accountable. I'm also involved with Stanford Labor Action Coalition, and we've been extremely busy with this year. There's one of the subcontractors on campus has had some extremely egregious human rights violations that we're fighting. And I'm also involved in a new coalition that we've been trying to get together since we started forming last spring, called Stanford Stands Up. And I would love to talk more about that. I think it's a really exciting new direction, it has a lot of potential for generating a new type of student movement that generates, that is very... very much about creating a larger analysis for why war, racism, poverty, the oppression of workers are all completely interrelated issues, and why we need to address these all together. Because campus groups tend to be very issue focused, and we really wanted to start talking about how these are related. And also equally important for this coalition is how Stanford is complicit in a lot of these injustices, both in how it treats workers and students on campus, and in what it's involved in and what it's supporting around the world. So whether that's through research or through its investments, etc. So so that's something really exciting right now.
That's a project that's been called that's called Stanford Stands Up.
Yes.
And this is kind of a gathering of different groups together.
Yes.
Wow,
it's a coalition.
It's a very interesting concept.
Mm-hmm.
Luke, why don't you introduce yourself?
My name is Luke Wigren, and I am a junior here at Stanford. Majoring in comparative studies of race and ethnicity with a focus on arts and community organizing. I haven't really done too much like group activism per se here on campus, but this last quarter I was working a lot on, heightening people's awareness of the swine flu issue and some of the deeper problems that issue that we talk about, we joke about, in many cases, how it taps into some larger problems with society, with healthcare, with media and political power being used as brought to a larger case during these types of hysterias and epidemics.
So you two, how did you two get together? How did you two end up on the radio together like this? Are you working on similar projects?
Well, I actually, Stanford Stands Up, that's one of the main groups that I got to know Shara through this quarter. And then we actually worked on Barack Obama's, Barack Obama's campaign last year.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Registering voters.
You were community organizers, which is what he was when he started out, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of people around the nation who, they're folks like me in our 50s, our 40s, whatever, are wondering that army of young people that stood up and helped him get elected, okay? What we saw this last summer was we saw the big protests about healthcare from older folks who'd been kind of, we believe they'd been duped. They're called the teabaggers. And a lot of that was brought on by lobbyists and other organizations. We saw those guys protest. But we haven't heard from that great army of people that helped Barack, mostly young people that helped Barack get elected. As two folks that worked on that campaign, what do you think of your president after about his first year in office? Not quite a total year, but what do you think of him? Shara, why don't you start? Just off the top of your head, what do you think? What feeling? Look, don't be afraid to say anything. It's okay.
Yeah.
Speak your mind.
I'm not afraid. I should first say that I wasn't organizing for Obama's campaign
at all.
Yeah, I misspoke. We were...
Registering voters.
Yeah, we were registering voters, and that helped a lot with Obama's campaign. So it is part of that wave because, that's part of... we had such a huge turnout from young people in that election, and that was crucial. I was never super excited. I was very excited about Obama, but I was never agreed with a lot of what he said. And I'm extremely disappointed with him, to put it lightly. But it's in some way, in some ways it's a surprise, in some ways it's a betrayal, and in other ways it's not. In other ways we knew this was coming, and since his election, I was very aware that he was not going to be able to, even the good things that he did promise, I knew it wasn't going to be that easy to push through, because he's one person, and the way that people were starting to kind of almost deify him and expect him to be able to get all this done was dangerous from the beginning. We can never do that, and I'm starting to really change, like, the way that I understand the, like, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. I don't really, I'm starting to think that we can never expect a president to change, to end the wars. That's gonna have to come from grassroots organizing. And what is, from the beginning, what I did love about Obama is that he, and the reason that I decided to vote for him, and it was very hard for me to make that decision, but the reason I decided to vote for him, because I disagreed with him so fundamentally on certain issues, regarding the war, especially, but the reason I decided to vote for him is because I thought that he would, more than any other possible candidate, would leave the door open for the people to actually push him, and for activists to make a difference. He would listen the most, because I've been very active against the war in Iraq since it started in 2003, and
you had to be in high school then, right?
I was 13, yeah.
Wow.
And we... I mean, I have been at, like, I don't know how many protests in D.C. where we had sometimes 500,000 people. And, you know, I have grown up in a community of activists who dedicate their lives to ending these wars. But so it's not that there isn't people out there who haven't been dedicated. It's that the Bush administration really didn't. It was amazing how much they didn't listen, how much they ignored us. And it was also made possible in large part because the media just completely ignored these protests. And I will never, like, forget that feeling of seeing, you know, seeing the MSNBC cameras at the protests panning the crowd, and then seeing the report the next day where they said a few hundred people came out or something, which is just a lie. But anyway, I am digressing.
Luke, what about you? How do you feel about Obama at almost the end of his first year?
I had the same, I guess, hesitance to ever really put all my faith in Obama from the beginning. I was definitely very happy. The campus was, like, super excited when he was elected.
We all were.
Yeah, but, you know, as with anything, like, it was more of a movement without a direction. Change, hope, these words, they don't really mean anything broad or in terms of policy. You know, what can they really do? And I know I was hoping that maybe with his election we'd see some like incremental gains in certain areas, but with the recent troop
escalation
in Afghanistan, I don't see that is a step in, it's a step in the wrong direction.
Did that kind of, was that it for you? Was that kind of a last straw kind of a thing? Like, oh, now he's going to send 30,000 more troops?
I think that happened a while ago.
Well, no, he just announced it last Tuesday night.
I know,
he has a big talk.
The point where the last straw happened a while ago, perhaps.
Oh, okay, yeah, I hear
you. I was going to say before, I didn't finish my point, but... was that he left the door open, right? And I think he has made that clear in speeches before, that, you know, I agree with the reasons to end the war, but you're going to have to make me do it, you know? And I think he made that pretty clear.
Well, he also said in the campaign, yeah, he said in the campaign that he was going to finish Iraq, well, you know, right, get out of Iraq, but he was going to do right war.
Afghanistan,
right?
Was never a surprise, right? Exactly. But in general, his stance was always that community organizations, as a community organizer, he knew that was important, and he was telling us, you know, telling the left in a way that you are going to have to keep up your activism, because I'm going to need to be able to point out the window and say they're making me do this, because a president is not, he doesn't have all the power. He is under, like, all this pressure from the corporate lobbies, etc. So it's not, he cannot do it alone. He has to be able to say that he has no choice because his constituencies are making him. And he has made that clear, and that's where we need to So really the only good thing about the Obama presidency is that he is a window that we haven't stepped through yet.
Now, as chosen community organizing, both of you have, I don't know if that's going to be your career, but you did that when you were registering voters, and it seems like that's the work you're doing now by getting this this new coalition together, Stanford Stands Up. By doing that, it seems that you've kind of become enlightened to the fact that until the people stand up and do something, the politicians won't. They'll keep doing what they always do. No matter what color, what age, you know, young ones come in, they get co-opted too. They've all been, because money is such a big part of politics, right? It costs so much money to get elected, even if you want to run for Congress. So you got to go looking for that real money. We heard a report today on Democracy Now! That a certain congressman threatened the insurance industry with hearings unless they gave him campaign contributions. He extorted the insurance companies. It's gotten that bad. And what do you guys feel is going to be your role after you get out of, after you graduate, as far as to help try to get some of these goals and wake people up and get a movement going? Because you come to the realization that nothing will change until the movement really gets going, right? Until the American people all wake up.
Yeah. I think that's primarily one of the big problems over the last couple of years. Even over the last year with Obama in power, we do have this figurehead that, you know, could rally us and that we could really push to do something, though we've dropped the ball. We thought that with the election, we're like, oh, great, we did it. Whereas I think moving on, we all know that wars are not stopped without the work and the power of the people. And I think for myself individually, that is just, it's a matter of first compelling people to get up, to stand up and do things about the issues that are so important to them and are so important to the, continuation of a just and equal democracy in this country. And also hopefully to push that message across the world too.
With all the disparate groups in this country, you know, pushing and pulling all in all different directions, you think we could really have a fair, straight-up democracy the way this country's set up? You think it's possible? Because we don't now, right? We know that. Yeah. We saw two rigged elections, 2000, 2004. Yeah. You know, what do you think about the future as far as having a nice, clean democracy? It's a nice, idealistic idea, but can we ever achieve it?
Yeah. I don't know. I don't think that I agree that this is not a democracy. Democracy means, and to most activists, that word means so much more than voting every 4 years.
It means everybody participates, right?
It means participation, exactly. And we don't have that. The structure of our country is anti-democratic, essentially. I mean, we don't have a say in the actual policies that are made. And part of me, one debate that I'm always having in my head is like, is it ever possible on such a large scale? I mean, that's like very theoretical type of thinking, but I think that democracy takes place locally. And I think that's really important to think about, even though it is very abstract and kind of, I always end up getting into that, starting to think about that when I'm trying to think about what my ideal world would look like. But I think there's important things to draw from that in how we move forward, because if we can focus on creating democracy within our communities, and move up from there, I mean, even with issues that are national issues, for example, the war, we can pass resolutions locally, then in our county, then in our state, we can still kind of try to use this this flawed system to kind of retake it for the people and force our government on the national level to listen to its people. I've learned a lot. I spent the summer in Nicaragua. And I was doing labor organizing there, and I learned a lot about that. Because one thing that there's a lot of problems with the new Sandinista administration right now. But it was amazing to me how much more democratic that society is than ours, despite the fact that, you know, our mainstream media is constantly accusing Ortega of trying to become a dictator and whatnot, like we do to anybody who the U.S. doesn't like. But in terms of on the ground in those communities, there was so much more participation. Everybody, I mean, these are people who, a lot of them living on less than a few dollars a day, some of them less than a dollar a day, and yet they know everything. So they are struggling to survive, but they know what's going on politically. And every evening, there is very like vibrant discussion about what is going on, the politics. I mean, the coup in Honduras happened this summer. That was, we were talking about that, like hours, every night, everybody, you know? And they have these CPCs, I forget right now what that stands for, but it's basically these community participatory councils that actually, they counsel the city government and or the, you know, county government or whatnot. So I had read about these before I went, because it's a new initiative of the Sandinista government, and they're all over the country. And I was very like interested and kind of skeptical. But then, I mean, it turned out that the family I lived with, who are union organizers, they were also huge organizers with this CPCs. And so I got to witness some of those meetings. And what does it look like? It looks like 30 people cramming into the, you know, the living room of their home and discussing what is the problem, what are the problems in the community, you know, like whether that be they need paved roads, the electricity isn't constant, or there's crime in this part of the neighborhood, whatever it is, you know. And then they go and they pressure their representatives, their elected representatives, to make these changes happen. And
that sounds like democracy in action.
That is democracy in action. And they've actually just had a huge success for the last 10 years. They've been pushing for, because this particular community is under this these huge like towers that are very, very toxic to live under for a long time. And so they were pressuring the government to build them new houses and move the community. And they finally got that to happen, incredibly, after 10 years of organizing. But to see that those meetings, like, it was, you know, it's not like it's pretty or clean or simple. It's very dirty and messy and like lots of disagreement, but it's happening in that living room, just like 30 people coming together and talking about what's going on, and then going to their government and actually, like, you know, through their numbers, making what their demands come true. So I don't mean to romanticize it, but I think that we can learn a lot from those kinds of systems, and that does require a certain level of decentralization. So,
two Stanford student activists on the air with us today for Shedding Light, Shara and Luke. And Luke, you got anything to add to that?
Yeah, I think it's actually really interesting, because it's not like we didn't see the same type of like grassroots local groups show up before the election, but I think even the one on El Camino, we had a Barack Obama field office. That one is like since, you know, closed down. People, you know, like pulled down the signs. And why didn't that continue after the election? I don't understand why, if Barack Obama does want to have us pushing him, and if he does have these policies and an agenda, he should keep these field offices open and keep that grassroots struggle, because there definitely was a democratic movement for his, you know, democratic election. We did have a lot of people, you know, in that, you know, crammed in rooms trying to get him elected.
Maybe
we need to be crammed in rooms to, you know, make policy change with his election.
Yeah, maybe in doing, maybe in working on that election, maybe that gave you guys a glimpse of what could be. If and Shara, by you going down to Nicaragua and seeing how they act down there, maybe that's a glimpse of what could be. But like both of you have said, you agree that until there's a mass movement in this country of people participating in the democracy, none of these idealistic ideas are going to work, are they? It's KZSU Shedding Light, two Stanford student activists on the air with us. We're going to take a short musical break, and we'll be back, and we're going to find out about this new coalition they've set up, Stanford Stands Up. Sounds like they got grassroots right here on campus, and we're going to find out more about it. Stand by. Donald Byrd, the great trumpet player, with his version of Amen. If you play it, you got to say it. That's what we say here on the air. And back with two Stanford student activists, and I want to apologize for not calling your last names for the last half hour, Luke Wigren, Wigren, and thank you, producer, and Shara Espenshade. Did I say it wrong?
No, that's correct.
Good, good. Shara, get a little closer to that mic and speak up a little more. Now, let's just start out the next segment by asking about this Stanford Stands Up. So you've created a coalition where you've brought together different groups of activists on campus. Speak about this. How did it get started? What is it? And all that. Run it down.
Shara, I think that's you.
Okay. The idea came from this Berkeley's campus last year. They had gotten together a coalition called Take Back Berkeley, which was a coalition of progressive groups from anti-war to groups active in kind of in a similar movement that happened last year on Stanford's campus to protect the community centers during the budget cuts, because the budget cuts very unfairly targeted the community centers, the Chicano Center, the Native Center, these LGBT Center, these kinds of resources, which are extremely important for students. So it was a combination of those movements with also Take Back Berkeley included environmentalist groups, all sorts of different groups, and they were doing really incredible things. So I wanted to get something similar to that together on this campus. So we started having discussions about it last spring, and what it's evolved into now is a group that's come together around four ideals: democracy, accountability, transparency, and the right to dissent. We're still developing our philosophy is under constant development, and where it might change that to participation.
Democracy, yeah. Accountability. What was the
right
third
to
one?
Dissent and transparency, which spells DART. Although we might change it to participation, accountability, the right to dissent, and transparency, as these being the four ideals that are necessary, or the four conditions that are necessary in order to actually have democracy. This is our main focus, and what we are focused on changing Stanford University and the way that it runs itself, its decision-making process, and making it democratic, transparent, accountable, and protect the right to dissent. So there's tons of problems with these on campus, and they affect the different movements a lot, although in different ways. So accountability is a huge issue, for example, for students confronting apartheid by Israel who are trying to push for divestment from companies that are profiting from the occupation of Palestine, but they haven't been able to even really work on that until they can actually make the investment portfolio public, or at least let students have access to it. Because right now, Stanford isn't required to make that public, and it's extremely difficult to find out where our investments, that's our money as students who pay tuition, that's our money, and we don't even know where it's going. So that's one way it impacts it. For what I'm much more familiar with is Stanford Labor Action Coalition. We finally gotten Stanford to take on a living wage policy, which is really great on paper, but they don't enforce it at all. There is no accountability. And there, again, transparency plays into it, because it's very difficult to find out how these decisions are made in terms of which contractors are hired. And it's highly problematic. We're gonna work on a campaign by campaign basis, basically, and push for structural change always. And so transparency will probably be our first campaign, and what that's going to look like in terms of our specific demands is what we're talking about right now, because there are so many places to begin. Of course, in the budget cuts, that's been a big issue too, because the budget cuts were decided on in a completely non-transparent way, with basically no input from the students, no actual input. I could go on forever.
Shara Espenshade, student activist here at Stanford, speaking about the new coalition of Stanford students and groups called Stanford Stands Up. Luke, you got anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, well, I've just heard about Stanford Stands Up this quarter, and I think the idea is terrific. I think that our school, and you know, probably a lot of the U.S. and many other schools, I think a lot of communities within the U.S. are just kind of broken apart right now with their different issues, different disparate interests.
Well, the Cal system is under great assault, right? You guys know about what's going on across the Bay and around the whole college system, the public college system here in California, mm-hmm. right? They're raising the fees, cutting the classes, laying a lot of people off. You got a lot of stuff like that going on. As you guys build this coalition, are you going to build it to last beyond when you get out of Stanford? Or is this a thing that's going to be a project while you're here, and then it'll end when you leave?
Sure. Did you want to finish what you...
Yeah, well, I was just going to say that, I think... Yeah, there's a little bit of like myopia and just like different interest groups. They want to, you know, achieve one thing, but they don't necessarily think about the interrelatedness mm-hmm. of their issue in comparison to like the institutions that are, you know, I guess giving authority and power and who are giving the ability to do something in the first place. Mm-hmm. And with this group, I think it's terrific that we could have students that may have different, you know, like issues that they're passionate about coming together on certain collective views and mm-hmm. Ideals about how the university, about how government should be run. Mm-hmm.
And do you think are you going to set this coalition up to last beyond you guys when you leave here? Or is this going to be something more of a right now kind of a thing, and then when you leave, it won't be together anymore?
Well, absolutely. We want it to last beyond the time that we leave. I think that universities are a crucial like strategic spot for activism, for changing larger problems in our society. And I think, I mean, what's going on at the UCs right now is hugely inspirational to us here at Stanford. And I think that what it hinges on, whether it continues at Stanford, is going to be... it's how passionate students are about it, which has to do with, you know, whether we're going to finally politicize ourselves and organize ourselves, because students at Stanford, I mean, it's not just students' fault. I think that the structure of this university as an elite school its main priority isn't making people think critically about the world.
Really?
I mean, not in my experience. I think that it's schools like these are kind of... it's a very establishment school in terms of the money that goes into it, in terms of what it supports. And there are a lot of people on campus that are very critical, but it's not the dominant mentality. And the dominant mentality is very much one of an upper class mentality that is more about justifying the system and the inequalities that exist rather than questioning them and looking critically at our role in perpetuating these inequalities and injustices. It's not common to do that at Stanford, and we have a lot of work in front of us to try to get students to start thinking critically about that stuff. That's why we've started with, you know, just looking at Stanford, just looking right here in front of our eyes, all of the ways in which we are complicit. Mm-hmm. That in itself can be scary, because it does mean recognizing our own involvement in our own, thinking critically about our relationship to these unjust power structures that define the world. And that's something that I think youth today, that's why so many of them are, it's not that people aren't active, and it's not that they don't care. People are very involved, but it tends to be mostly with, and they are very moved by the suffering that happens in this world, but they tend to get involved through apolitical means, service initiatives that are almost stubbornly apolitical. And that also has to do with the whole nonprofit complex, which is very present and on campus in terms of what gets funding, you know, what is encouraged. Nothing that is, I mean, this is very like broadly speaking, but the tendency is that what is encouraged and what is funded and what is easiest to do here is not political stuff, and it's not anything that questions the structures. So students are active, but they tend to be active in things that are, one, looking far away. You know, people will go halfway around the world to like build homes or do all sorts of great initiatives. And I'm not saying that these are wrong at all. I'm just saying that it's also necessary to think critically about why these problems exist in the first place, especially because the United States is very much involved in that in the reasons for our poverty around the world, and other issues.
I think a lot of this, the apoliticization within the institution, within like the within Stanford University and the different groups, they get funding and have power. I think once a student gets into it, I think it deters them, this lack of like achievement in like doing something and like making, and I guess like feeling that that excitement and that power of making something happen. Without that, I think, you know, it really just deters people from doing it in general. I know when I got to Stanford, I had been doing a lot of work in my own high school on issues of counter-militarism and counter-recruitment.
Where was that?
This is in Seattle. This is in Renton, Washington.
Real hotbed.
Yeah.
Seattle's very subversive. Not subversive, but very, very progressive, isn't it? It's a progressive town, isn't it?
Oh, I mean, I guess it can be. I mean, I definitely had a lot of resources and a lot of people to talk to and then bring issues back to my high school.
That's where Rachel Corrie came from, too, right?
Yeah, Olympia.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So, I think one of the things is, like, when I got here and I saw just the stagnation within groups, within interest groups, just people, you know, going to meetings and not necessarily like involving themselves in the excitement of protest or of rallying or of, I guess, pushing. Like that really made me disheartened, because I didn't want to necessarily go to meetings. I mean, they're great, but after a meeting, you definitely need some excitement, you need some fun, rally.
Why is that? Why do you think it is that way when you got, you know, when you got here and saw that? What did you must have asked yourself? Why is it like that here? Why isn't it more like where I came from?
It's a lot of it's time, and you know, we're very, especially like right now. I mean, we're balancing a lot of different.
You guys are strapped.
Yeah.
And the modern student is saddled with an amazing amount of debt, right?
Yes.
Even when you get to go to Stanford, even if you got a scholarship, you still end up having to take loans. The way this whole system is set up, whether you go to public university or you go to private, the modern student gets out of college owing, what would you say an average number is? Hundreds of thousands of dollars, right?
Yeah, that's a huge problem. But I would also say that the time, I think the fact that students don't have time for activism is a symptom of the culture, not a cause of the anti-activist culture, if that makes sense. I think like the fact that we don't have time, I mean, time is something you make and it reflects your priorities. The fact that students don't have time to be activists, that in itself says that it's not their priority, that they are not activists. I mean, it's not like anybody does activism because they are bored. You do activism because you feel compelled to. You know that it is crucial. Your own liberation requires you to be active and contributing to building a new society and changing the way things are. So I think that to me, that the answer, like I also came from it's not a town that's necessarily known for its activism, but Urbana-Champaign, Illinois. And there was a lot of activism going on there compared to here. I was expecting to come to the Bay Area and just be inundated with lots of cool initiatives. And like I said, it's a very active campus at Stanford, but none of it is the type of stuff that I was doing at home, where, you know, none of it was actually thinking outside the box. None of it was critiquing the structures. Mm-hmm. And that's what this whole coalition is about. It's about getting to the root of the problem. That's our most fundamental philosophy, is that we will never solve things in the long run unless we do look at the structures and why they are causing things to be the way that they are. Although it's also crucial to, at the same time, do the type of service work that saves people's lives right now, because people are suffering in the present moment as well.
They're suffering all around you too, not just outside. Outside this country or outside the state.
Right, and that's another major premise of ours, is that we refuse to only look abroad, to only, you know, I think that it's, we cannot just, we have to recognize the suffering that's happening right here in our backyard.
Well, you spoke about that last time you were on the show, Shara, the first time you came on last month with Paul George. You've talked about going in your work on the trying to help out the laborers here at Stanford with the business that you students went over to the yard of that company and confronted those guys, and you said it wasn't too pleasant an experience. They gave you a really hard time, right? That's the cutting edge of what activism is all about, being willing to go out of your comfort zone and go confront something where you know you're going to get confronted, and you know it's not going to be pleasant, but that's a taste of what activism really is, and you're doing it. You're definitely doing it. Luke, what do you think about all this stuff?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's definitely easy to just, I mean, we have everything we need here on campus. We can just sit on our haunches and kind of wait
until
we graduate
of it, the way
and then confront something.
Mm-hmm. So life is is it easier here than it would be in, say, another place?
Well, yeah, and I think we all realize that, too, right? I don't think there's any, ignorance to the fact that, I don't know. I mean, I think many of us know that we're going to have a lot to confront when we leave this institution, but I don't think that we're preparing ourselves for that right now.
Well, maybe you won't. I mean, you could get a nice piece of paper from Stanford and go get a nice corporate job.
Yeah. Exactly. That's exactly what most people want to do.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. And again, that goes back to if I was personally saddled with hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt when I got out of college, mm-hmm. the thing I'd be worried about is paying that debt off.
Exactly.
And so it's almost like it's the structure of that trap has been set up in such a way that you have no choice.
Yeah, and I mean, even at the university, there's a lot more emphasis on individual success rather than group or collective success.
Mm.
And you know, I think we'll all die, fight so hard for what it is that we'd like to achieve, but we don't necessarily think about what we'd like to achieve as a student group. Or as a university, as like an entire,
as a movement.
As a campus group of students.
Mm-hmm. And just to let you guys know, as students, you're sitting in one of the student organizations that's nonprofit, and we have to care of ourselves, and we do get funded by the students. So we're always concerned that, and this is why we've invited you on today, too, because we want a greater connection with the students. The students don't have time to listen to KZSU like a lot of people think they would. We do broadcast Stanford Sports, so we have a great connection there.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to get the vote for funding every year, and that concerns us, and we have to work for that. Also, we find it hard maintaining enough student activity in here because, again, to draw students in and get them interested, and this is real live radio being heard around the world right now, so it is a big deal. Mm-hmm. But we always felt like, well, when I got here 20 years ago, it used to be a larger percentage of students. I can't say the exact number. And over the last few years, it's gone down, and we've tried to figure out why. And I think one of the reasons is this whole debt thing, that students are so concerned with paying off that debt when they get out of college that they don't have time to play around. They got to get busy, get that piece of paper, and get out there in the world and pay that debt off so they can, get that house, get that career, start a family, or whatever they want to do. What do you think about that?
I don't know. I mean, I know that at Stanford, we're actually really lucky just because we do have one of the most generous financial aid plans. And so I think a lot of us, we aren't necessarily as concerned. But at the same time, I think that we also maybe feel more indebted to the institution just because we are, receiving so much from them.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's almost like a collusion of just like,
you don't want to bite the hand that feeds you.
Exactly, exactly. Which may be a good thing or a bad thing. I don't know. I mean, we're less concerned about that financial aspect, but we're also more indebted.
Somebody explained it to me one time about the endowment too. A lot of people like to look at Stanford and say, well, they got all that money in the bank.
Mm-hmm.
But what money was given up by Mrs. Stanford to keep this university going into perpetuity. That means forever, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the folks that are in charge of that account, their job is to make sure, because if that account ever went down, ever went out, this university wouldn't exist anymore. And so you really can't blame the folks that do everything they can to keep the endowment going,
mm-hmm.
because it's here to make sure that folks like you get an education. And you are kind of free to pick your classes, right? Nobody's telling you what you have to study and what you can't study.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, you got a great amount of freedom here, and they did kind of make it nice. So it seems like the stage is set to be whatever you want to be.
Yeah.
Right?
That's a very, I don't know. This is a very nice picture that we're painting, but underneath all of this, Stanford is still, first, if we're talking about students and how nicely they're treated, Yeah, sure. We have a lot of luxury. I mean, this campus, if you look around, it's like a resort. It's way too, like, uncomfortably beautiful, you know? And
well, if they did do that with the intention of making life easy enough for you, so you don't have to worry about that part. You don't live in a bad neighborhood.
Right.
You don't have to go far to class. You got all the amenities you need. Now, go get
an
education.
Great. I don't think that our what we should be wanting is a nice, aesthetically beautiful campus. What we
do you want to live
is,
in a bad neighborhood and have to go 20 miles to class?
No, but the important thing is having control over your own life and your own university, the institution that that you're living under for 4 years. We don't have a decision making. We don't have a say in decision making. The ASSU is pretty toothless, and I think that it could take more power than it does, and I think that's associated with, I mean, the general attitude toward authority on this campus is very submissive. I believe that what is far more important to me, I guess I should just speak for myself, to me personally, I would much rather live on a campus that prioritizes student involvement in decision making at the university over giving you free food as much as it can and having nicely, kept palm trees, etc. That is not an excuse for not allowing students to have a say in the way the university is run, especially because this university impacts an enormous community, not just the students and the faculty, but also the workers on campus. We are an enormous employer in this area, and we treat our workers, frankly, we treat them very badly. And we can't just ignore this and say, oh, but, you know, it's such a beautiful campus. I mean, this all happens under the surface, and I believe that part of the solution to rectifying that problem is having students, changing the structure of decision making so that students too can have a say, so that students and workers are on the board of trustees rather than, you know, just being constantly thankful and grateful to this university.
Well, you got your work cut out for you then,
yeah,
don't you?
Do
you see that as an area that you might go into, Shara?
Well, that's what this whole coalition is about.
You're going to try to change that structure so the students can be more involved
that's
in the decision-making process?
That is the entire point, yes.
Good. I think that's great. This is a great jumping-off point for what you'll run into when you get out of college, too, because when you get out of university, the greater world is just like that, too. And there's a lot of ambivalence out there. People don't care. You know, the anti-war protests, there's 300 million people in this country. They might have had 4 or 5 million at its very peak. That's not even a mere, that doesn't worry anybody. They're not going to get worried till they see 50 or 100 million people in the streets, right? So you can call it an anti-war movement, but if there's only 3 or 4 million out of 300 million, it's not really a movement that worries anybody. So they're going to continue to do what they want to do.
Yeah. And that's another level of comfort. I mean, that's not even having to do with Stanford, but just the fact that, I mean, with the anti-war protests and with the entire way that the war was run over the past, 7 years, we had a tremendous disconnect from the suffering in this war, more than any other, I believe, just because it was seen as something that was going on in another part of the world, as most are. And then, especially with our own, what we were asked to give up for this war was very little. And it was only on a case-by-case basis. For the recruitment effort, we could pass off the, blatant, problems with recruiting and discrimination, also targeting of the recruiting practices by saying that, oh, well, they signed it. They signed the paper. They're the ones that are responsible for, going over to fight in these wars. And people could, just pass off their implicitness because they weren't paying. They weren't sending their own sons or daughters. They didn't have to necessarily.
Do you two have friends in the military?
Yeah.
Do you know anybody?
Mm-hmm.
Have they gone to Iraq or Afghanistan?
Yeah.
Really? Have they come back?
Yeah. Most have.
Did you talk to them?
I mean, actually, no, all of them have. And yeah, I've talked to them.
What'd they say? What was your general feeling?
Even there, there's a little bit of a disconnect, I think. My friends who have served in the military for the past, like, 4 or 5 years, and a lot of the individuals that, you know, made me compelled to start doing my activism in high school, the military itself is very insulated over in other countries like Iraq and Afghanistan, just because we've, like, you know, I guess just these bases that they're living on, they're, you know, living in, you know, essentially like, you know, green zones resorts within these other countries where they're also fighting and, you know, carrying out offensives. And I don't know, I think that they're even a little bit disconnected from the, you know, types of institution that they're serving, though they are on the front lines.
How were they affected by it when they came back? Were they different when they came back?
I guess just disillusioned. It's really hard to, like, pinpoint one thing, but I think, you know, my friends that I went to high school with, they're maybe like a year or two older, just, I mean, essentially this a lot of drinking, I think, and a lot of just disillusionment, just kind of being just sour in general.
Well, yeah. War will tend to do that to you. If you see war up close and that involves death and destruction and not always the enemy, a lot of times it's collateral damage, they like to call it that. That happens to be women and children, right?
Yeah.
They get killed too. And if a normal human being witnesses that, it's going to affect you in a major way. And you might be okay day to day right then, but when you get back home and start having nightmares, that's why they call it PTSD, because it does screw you up. And that's the legacy that we're going to be left with, of trying to repair all those broken lives of those folks that went out there and did that. And they were all on a noble cause. They're all out there protecting their country.
Yeah.
And they all believe it too.
And I think getting back to the question, though, it was these protests, the reason that I think they were so they were large in some cases, and they were downplayed in a lot of cases, but to compel people to, you know, rise up to take action in this democracy, when they didn't necessarily have anything immediately affecting them with these wars, with the different issues of oppression that they were complicit in but maybe not aware of, it was very hard to get people out to take the time out of their day to go protest. And I know that, I mean, one of my main goals, especially in like a group like Stanford Stands Up, is to not only compel people but to make it fun for them, to make it exciting, because I think that's one of the only things. If you don't have a direct connection to the problems that you're rallying against, you have to you know, enjoy and be excited about what you're doing.
I think that's true, and that's in our mission statement at the end, is we're gonna change this university and we're gonna have a fun time doing it. At the same time, part of our struggle is to make people realize, and you know, our generation more than any other perhaps is obsessed with immediate effect, immediate results, and activism is not about that. Activism requires being committed in the long run, and it requires lots of boring, long meetings and emails and all of that. And we have to be ready to do that. There are fun parts, but an activist, I mean, it's a huge misconception in the mainstream, is that activism is just going out in the streets and screaming. Actually, every single protest is, you know, like a year's worth of work.
It's a slog. Yeah. For sure. But and at the same time, though, I think the benefits of just having that communal sense of achievement and doing something every step of the way, I think that's the primary reason. I mean, that's the thing that
down
would
our goals into
keep someone coming back, for sure.
Go ahead, Luke.
I don't know if you want to talk about, I read the email.
We got about a minute left.
Oh, okay, never
mind. Make it brief. Okay, well, Luke Wigren and Shara Espenshade, you've been the guest for the hour. You guys are getting ready to take your finals and then take the winter break.
Mm-hmm.
And then, Shara, you're going off, right?
Yeah, I am.
Where are you going?
I'm going to Central America.
All right.
Back there, yeah.
Stay out of trouble.
Thanks.
And Luke, we want you to stay in touch and keep us filled in on what's going on, because this show here is dedicated to everything that's going on in the world.
Absolutely.
Stanford matters, okay?
Absolutely.
We probably won't have you on before the take off of the break, so I want to wish you well. Is there a website for Stanford Stands Up?
Not yet.
Okay.
We're working on that.
All right.
Yeah.
Keep us posted on that one.
For
you guys
sure.
have a nice holiday.
Mm-hmm.
And,
thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. You too. Have a great holiday.
Yeah, and keep up all the good work too, okay?
Thanks.
All right, stand by for Raising Sand.
Oh, no, I wanted you to...